either naturally occurring or man-made. But how in the world could gas appear in the middle of the woods, in such a remote part of the country? I couldn't account for it. Poison gas, though, would logically explain what I saw that day. Everyone breathed it in, went unconscious, and collapsed on the spot. The homeroom teacher had not collapsed, because the concentration of gas wasn't strong enough to affect an adult. When it came to treating the children, though, I was totally at a loss. I'm just a simple country doctor, and have no special expertise in poison gases, so I was out of my league. We were out in this remote town, and I couldn't very well ring up a specialist. Very gradually, in fact, some of the children were getting better. And I figured that perhaps with time they would all regain consciousness. I know it's an overly optimistic view. But at the time I couldn't think of anything else to do. So I suggested that we just let them lie there quietly for a while and see what developed.
Was there anything unusual in the air?
I was concerned about that myself, so I took several deep breaths to see if I could detect any unusual odour. But it was just the smell of a wood in the hills. It was a bracing scent, the fragrance of trees. Nothing unusual about the plants and flowers around there either. Nothing had changed shape or been discoloured. One by one, I examined the mushrooms the children had been picking. There weren't all that many, which led me to conclude that they'd collapsed not long after they began picking them. All of them were normal, edible mushrooms. I've been a doctor here for some time, and am quite familiar with the different varieties. Of course, to be on the safe side, I collected them all and took them back, and had an expert examine them. As far as I could tell, though, they were all your common or garden edible mushrooms.
You said that the unconscious children's eyes moved back and forth. But did you notice any other unusual symptoms or reactions? For instance, the size of their pupils, the colour of the whites of their eyes, the frequency of their blinking?
No. Other than their eyes moving back and forth like searchlights, there was nothing out of the ordinary. All other functions were completely normal. The children were looking at something. To put a finer point on it, the children weren't looking at what we could see, but at something we couldn't. It was more like they were observing something rather than just looking at it. They were essentially expressionless, but overall they seemed calm, not afraid, or in any pain. That's also one of the reasons I decided to just let them lie there and see how things played out. I decided, if they're not in any pain, then just let them be for a while.
Did anyone mention the idea that the children had been gassed?
Yes, they did. But like me, they couldn't figure out how it was possible. I mean, no one had ever heard of somebody going on a hike in the woods and ending up being gassed. Then one of the people there, the assistant principal, I believe it was, said it might have been gas dropped by the Americans. They must have dropped a bomb with poison gas, he said. The homeroom teacher recalled seeing what looked like a B-29 in the sky just before they started up the hill, flying directly overhead. That's it, everyone said. Some new poison gas bomb the Americans had developed. Rumours about the Americans developing a new kind of bomb had even reached our neck of the woods. But why would the Americans drop their newest weapon in such an out-of-the-way place? That we couldn't explain. But mistakes are part of life, and some things we aren't meant to understand, I suppose.
After this, then, the children gradually recovered on their own?
They did. I can't tell you how relieved I was. At first they started squirming around, then sat up unsteadily, gradually regaining consciousness. No one complained of any pain during this process. It was all very quiet, as if they were waking from a deep sleep. And as they regained consciousness, their eye movements became normal again. They showed normal reactions to light when I shone a flashlight in their eyes. It took some time, though, for them to be able to speak again, just as you are when you first wake up. We asked each of the children what had happened, but they looked dumbfounded, as if we were asking them about something they didn't remember taking place. Going up the hill, starting to gather mushrooms, that much they recalled. Everything after that was a total blank. They had no sense of any time passing between then and now. They start gathering mushrooms, then the curtain falls, and here they are lying on the ground, surrounded by all these adults. The children couldn't figure out why we were all upset, staring at them with these worried looks on our faces. They seemed more afraid of us than anything else. Sadly, there was one child, a boy, who didn't regain consciousness. One of the children evacuated from Tokyo. Satoru Nakata, I believe his name was. A pale little boy. He was the only one who remained unconscious. He just lay there on the ground, his eyes moving back and forth. We had to carry him down the hill. The other children walked down as if nothing had happened.
Other than this boy, Nakata, none of the other children exhibited any symptoms later on.
As far as any outward signs, at least, no. They displayed no unusual symptoms. No one complained of pain or discomfort. As soon as we got back to the school, I brought the children into the nurse's room one by one and examined them, took their temperature, listened to their heart with a stethoscope, checked their vision. Whatever I was able to do at the time, I did. I had them solve some simple arithmetic problems. Stand on one foot with their eyes closed, things like that. Physically, they were fine. They didn't seem tired, and had a healthy appetite. They'd missed lunch, so they all said they were hungry. We gave them rice balls to eat, and they gobbled them up. A few days later, I stopped by the school to observe how the children were doing. I called a few of them into the nurse's room and questioned them. Again, though, everything seemed fine. No trace remained, physically or emotionally, from their strange experience. They couldn't even remember that it had happened. Their lives were back to normal, unaffected by the incident. They attended class as usual, sang songs, played outside during recess. Everything normal kids did. Their homeroom teacher, however, was a different story. She still seemed in shock. That one boy, Nakata, though, didn't regain consciousness. So the following day he was taken to the university hospital in Corfu. After that he was transferred to a military hospital and never came back to our town again. I never heard what became of him. This incident never made the newspapers. My guess is the authorities decided it would only cause unrest, so they censored any mention of it. You have to remember that during the war, the military tried to squelch whatever they saw as groundless rumours. The war wasn't going well, with the military retreating on the southern front, suicide attacks one after the other, air raids on cities getting worse all the time. The military was especially afraid of any anti-war or pacifist sentiment cropping up among the populace. A few days after the incident, the police came calling and warned us that under no circumstances were we to talk about what we'd seen. The whole thing was an odd, unpleasant affair. Even to this day, it's like a weight pressing down on me.
5. I'm asleep when our bus drives across the huge new bridge over the inland sea. I'd seen the bridge only on maps, and had been looking forward to seeing it for real. Somebody taps me gently on the shoulder and I wake up. "We're here," the girl says. I stretch, rub my eyes with the back of my hand, and look out of the window. Sure enough, the bus is just pulling into what looks like the square in front of a station. Fresh morning sunlight lights up the scene, almost blinding, but gentle somehow. The light is different from what I was used to in Tokyo. I glance at my watch. 6:32. Gosh, what a long trip, she says tiredly. I thought my lower back was going to give out, and my neck's killing me. You aren't going to catch me on an all-night bus again. I'm taking the plane from now on, even if it's more expensive. Turbulence, hijackings, I don't care. Give me a plane any day. I lower her suitcase and my backpack from the overhead rack. What's your name? I ask. My name? Yeah. Sakura, she says. What about you? Kafka Tamura, I reply. Kafka Tamura, she muses. Weird name. Easy to remember, though. I nod. Becoming a different person might be hard, but taking on a different name is child's play. She gets off the bus, sets her suitcase on the ground, and plonks herself down on top of it. She pulls a notebook from a pocket in her small backpack, scribbles down something, rips the page out, and hands it to me. A phone number by the look of it. My mobile phone number, she says with a wry expression. I'm staying at my friend's place for a while, but if you ever feel like seeing somebody, give me a call. We can go out for a bite or whatever. Don't be a stranger, okay? Even chance meetings. How does the rest of that go? Are the result of karma. Right, right, she says. But what does it mean? That things in life are fated by our previous lives. That even in the smallest events, there's no such thing as coincidence. She sits there on her yellow suitcase, notebook in hand, giving it some thought. That's a kind of philosophy, isn't it? Not such a bad way of thinking about life. Sort of a reincarnation, new age kind of thing. But Kafka, remember this, okay? I don't go around giving my mobile phone number to just anybody. You know what I mean? I appreciate it, I tell her. I fold the piece of paper and stick it in the pocket of my wind cheater. Thinking better of it, I transfer it to my wallet. So how long will you be in Takamatsu? Sakura asks. I don't know yet, I say. It depends on how things go. She gazes intently at me, her head tilted to one side. Okay. Whatever she might be thinking. She climbs into a taxi, gives a little wave, and is gone. Once again, I'm all alone. Sakura, I think. Not my sister's name. But names are changed easily enough, especially when you're trying to run away from somebody. I have a reservation at a business hotel in Takamatsu. The YMCA in Tokyo had told me about the place, and through them, I got a discount on the room. But that's only for the first 3 days, then it goes back to the normal room rate. If I really wanted to save money, I could just sleep out on a bench in front of the station, or since it's still warm out, I could stop in my sleeping bag in a park somewhere. But then the police will come and check my ID, the one thing I have to avoid at all costs. That's why I went for the hotel reservation, at least for 3 days. After that, I'll work something out. At the station, I nip into the first little cafe that catches my eye and eat my fill of udon. Born and raised in Tokyo, I haven't had much udon in my life. But now I'm in Udon Central, Shikoku, and confronted with noodles like nothing I've ever seen. They're chewy and fresh, and the soup smells great, really fragrant. And talk about cheap. It all tastes so good I order seconds, and for the first time in who knows how long, I'm happily stuffed. Afterwards, I plop myself down on a bench in the plaza next to the station and gaze up at the sunny sky. I'm free, I remind myself. Like the clouds floating across the sky, I'm all by myself, totally free. I decide to kill time till the evening at a library. Ever since I was little, I've loved to spend time in the reading rooms of libraries. So I've come to Takamatsu armed with info on all the libraries in and around the city. Think about it. A little kid who doesn't want to go home doesn't have many places he can go. Coffee shops and cinemas are off limits. That leaves only libraries, and they're perfect. No entrance fee, nobody getting all hot and bothered if a young boy comes in. You just sit down and read whatever you want. I always rode my bike to the local public library after school. Even on holidays, that's where you'd find me. I devour anything and everything. Novels, biographies, histories, whatever was lying around. Once I'd gone through all the children's books, I went on to the general stacks and books for adults. I might not always get much out of them, but I forged on to the very last page. When I got tired of reading, I'd go into one of those listening booths with headphones and enjoy some music. I had no idea about music, so I just went down the row of CDs they had there, giving them all a listen. That's how I got to know about Duke Ellington, the Beatles, and Led Zeppelin. The library was like a second home, or maybe more like a real home than the place I lived in. By going every day, I got to know all the lady librarians who worked there. They knew my name and always said hi. I was painfully shy, though, and could scarcely reply. Before coming to Takamatsu, I found out that some wealthy man from an old family in the suburbs had refurbished his personal library into a private library open to the public. The place has a lot of rare books, and I heard that the building itself and surrounding garden were worth checking out. I saw a photo of the place once in the Taiyo magazine. It's a large, Japanese-style house with this really elegant reading room that looks more like a parlour, where people are sitting with their books on comfortable-looking sofas. For some reason, that photo really stayed with me, and I wanted to see this in person if someday the chance came along. The Komura Memorial Library, the place was called. I go over to the tourist information booth at the station and ask how to get there. A pleasant, middle-aged lady marks the spot on a tourist map and gives me instructions on which train to take. It's about a 20-minute ride, she explains. I thank her and study the timetable posted inside the station. Trains run about every 20 minutes. I have some time, so I pick up a takeaway lunch at one of the little shops. The train is just two small carriages coupled together. The tracks cut through a high-rise shopping district, then past a mix of small shops and houses, factories and warehouses. Next comes a park and an apartment building under construction. I press my face against the window, drinking in the unfamiliar sights. I've hardly ever been outside Tokyo, and everything looks fresh and new. The train I'm on, going out of town, is nearly empty this time of the morning. But the platforms on the other side are packed with junior and senior high school kids in summer uniforms, school bags slung across their shoulders, all heading to school. Not me, though. I'm alone, going in the opposite direction. We're on different tracks in more ways than one. All of a sudden, the air feels thin, and something heavy is bearing down on my chest. Am I really doing the right thing? The thought makes me feel helpless, isolated. I turn my back on the school kids and try not to look at them anymore. The train runs beside the sea for a time, then cuts inland. We pass tall fields of corn, grapevines, tangerine trees growing on terraced hills. An occasional irrigation pond sparkles in the sunlight. A river winding through a flat stretch of land looks cool and inviting. An empty lot is overgrown with summer grasses. At one point, we pass a dog standing by the tracks, staring vacantly at the train rushing by. Watching this scenery makes me feel warm and calm all over again. You're going to be okay, I tell myself, taking a deep breath. All you can do is forge on ahead. At the station, I follow the map and walk north past rows of old shops and houses. Both sides of the street are lined with walls around people's homes. I've never seen so many different kinds. Black walls made out of boards, white walls, granite block walls, stone walls with hedges on top. The whole place is still and silent, with no one else on the street. Hardly any cars pass by. The air smells like the sea, which must be nearby. I listen carefully, but can't hear any waves. Far off, though, I hear the faint bee-like buzz of an electric saw, maybe from a construction site. Small sign arrows pointing towards the library line the road from the station, so I can't get lost. Right in front of the Komura Memorial Library's imposing front gate stand two neatly trimmed plum trees. Inside the gate, a gravel path winds past other beautifully manicured bushes and trees, pines and magnolias, caria and azaleas, with not a fallen leaf in sight. A couple of stone lanterns peek out between the trees, as does a small pond. Finally, I get to the intricately designed entrance. I come to a halt in front of the open front door, hesitating for a moment about going inside. This place doesn't look like any library I've ever seen. But having come all this way, I might as well take the plunge. Just inside the entrance, a young man is sitting behind a counter where you check your bags. I slough off my backpack, then take off my sunglasses and cap. "Is this your first visit?" he asks me in a relaxed, quiet voice. It's slightly high-pitched, but smooth and soothing. I nod, but the words don't come. The question takes me by surprise and makes me kind of tense. A long, freshly sharpened pencil between his fingers, the young man studies my face for a while. The pencil is yellow, with a rubber at the end. The man's face is on the small side, his features regular. Pretty rather than handsome might describe him best. He's wearing a button-down white cotton shirt and olive-green chinos, with not a single wrinkle on either. When he looks down, his longish hair falls over his brow, and occasionally he notices this and fingers it back. His sleeves are rolled up to the elbows, revealing slender white wrists. Delicately framed glasses nicely complement his features. The small plastic name tag pinned to his chest says Oshima. Not exactly the type of librarian I'm used to. "Feel free to use the stacks," he tells me. "And if you find a book you'd like to read, just bring it to the reading room. Rare books have a red seal on them, and for those you'll need to fill out a request card. Over there to the right is the reference room. There's a card index system and a computer you can use to search for material. We don't allow any books to be taken out. We don't carry any magazines or newspapers. No cameras are allowed, and neither is making copies of anything. All food and beverages should be consumed outside on the benches. And we close at 5. He lays his pencil on the desk and adds, "Are you in high school?" "Yes, I am," I say after taking a deep breath. "This library is a little different from the ones you're probably used to," he says. "We specialize in certain genres of books, mainly old books by Tanka and haiku poets. Naturally, we have a selection of general books as well. Most of the people who take the train all the way out here are doing research in those fields. No one comes here to read the latest Stephen King novel. We might get the occasional graduate student, but very seldom someone your age. So, are you researching Tanka or haiku then?" "No," I answer. "I thought not." "Is it still okay for me to use the library?" I ask timidly, trying to keep my voice from cracking. "Of course." He smiles and places both hands on the desk. "This is a library, and anybody who wants to read is welcome. This can be our little secret, but I'm not particularly fond of Tanka or haiku myself." "It's a really beautiful building," I say. He nods. "The Komura family's been a major sake producer since the Edo period," he explains. "And the previous head of the family was quite a bibliophile, nationally famous for scouring the country in search of books. His father was himself a Tanka poet, and many writers used to stop here when they came to Shikoku. Wakayama Bokusui, for instance, or Ishikawa Takuboku, and Shiga Naoya. Some of them must have found it quite comfortable here, because they stayed a long time. All in all, the family spared no expense when it came to the literary arts. What generally happens with a family like that is that eventually a descendant squanders the inheritance, but fortunately, the Komuras avoided that fate. They enjoyed their hobby in its place, but made sure the family business did well." "So they were rich," I say, stating the obvious. "Very much so." His lips curve ever so slightly. "They aren't as rich now as they were before the war, but they're still pretty well off, which is why they can maintain such a wonderful library. Of course, making it a foundation helps lower their inheritance tax, but that's another story. If you're really interested in this building, I suggest you take the short tour at 2. It's only once a week, on Tuesdays, which happens to be today. There's a rather unique collection of paintings and drawings on the first floor, and the building itself is architecturally quite fascinating. I know you'll enjoy it." "Thank you," I say. "You're quite welcome," his smile implies. He picks up his pencil again and starts tapping the rubber end on the desk as if he's gently encouraging me. Are you the one who does the tour? Ooshma smiles. No, I'm just a lowly assistant, I'm afraid. A lady named Miss Saiki is in charge here, my boss. She's related to the Komuras and does the tour herself. I know you'll like her. She's a wonderful person. I go into the high-ceilinged stacks and wander among the shelves, searching for a book that looks interesting. Magnificent thick beams run across the ceiling of the room, and soft early summer sunlight is shining through the open window, the chatter of birds in the garden filtering in. The books on the shelves in front of me, sure enough, are just as Oshima said, mainly books of Japanese poetry, tanka and haiku, essays on poetry, biographies of various poets. There are also a lot of books on local history. A shelf further back contains general humanities, collections of Japanese literature, world literature, and individual writers, classics, philosophy, drama, art history, sociology, history, biography, geography. When I open them, most of the books have the smell of an earlier time leaking out from between their pages. A special odor of the knowledge and emotions that for ages have been calmly resting between the covers. Breathing it in, I glance through a few pages before returning each book to its shelf. Finally, I decide on a multi-volume set with beautiful covers of the Burton translation of The Arabian Nights. Pick out one volume and take it back to the reading room. I've been meaning to read this book. Since the library has just opened for the day, there's no one else there, and I have the elegant reading room all to myself. It's exactly like in the photo in the magazine. Roomy and comfortable, with a high ceiling. Every once in a while, a gentle breeze blows in through the open window, the white curtain rustling softly, in air that has a hint of the sea. And I love the comfortable sofa. An old upright piano stands in a corner, and the whole place makes me feel as though I'm in some friend's house. As I relax on the sofa and gaze around the room, a thought hits me. This is exactly the place I've been looking for all my life. A little hideaway in some sinkhole somewhere. I'd always thought of it as a secret, imaginary place, and can barely believe that it actually exists. I close my eyes and take a breath, and the wonder of it all settles over me like a gentle cloud. Slowly, I stroke the creamish cover of the sofa, then stand up and walk over to the piano and lift the lid, laying all 10 fingers on the faintly yellowing keys. I close the lid and cross the faded, grape-patterned carpet to the window and test the antique handle that opens and closes it. I switch the floor lamp on and off, then check out all the paintings hanging on the walls. Finally, I flop back down on the sofa and pick up where I left off, concentrating on The Arabian Nights for a while. At noon, I take my bottle of mineral water and box lunch out to the veranda that faces the garden and sit down to eat. Different kinds of birds fly overhead, fluttering from one tree to the next or flying down to the pond to drink and groom themselves. There are some I've never seen before. A large brown cat makes an appearance, which is their signal to clear off, even though the cat looks as though he couldn't care less about birds. All he wants to do is stretch out on the stepping stones and enjoy the warm sunlight. "Is your school closed today?" Oshima asks when I drop off my backpack on the way back to the reading room. "No," I reply, choosing my words carefully. "I just decided to take some time off." "Refusing to go to school," he says. "I guess so." Oshima looks at me with great interest. "You guess so?" "I'm not refusing to go. I just decided not to." "Very calmly, all on your own, you stopped going to school." I merely nod. I have no idea how to reply. "According to Aristophanes in Plato's The Banquet, in the ancient world of legend, there were 3 types of people," Oshima says. "Have you heard about this?" "No." "In ancient times, people weren't simply male or female, but one of 3 types. Male-male, male-female, or female-female. In other words, each person was made out of the components of two people. Everyone was happy with this arrangement and never really gave it much thought. But then God took a knife and cut everyone in half, right down the middle. So after that, the world was divided just into male and female. The upshot being that people spend their time running around trying to locate their missing other half. Why did God do that? Divide people into two. You've got me. God works in mysterious ways. There's that whole wrath of God thing. All that excessive idealism and so on. My guess is it was punishment for something. As in the Bible. Adam and Eve and the fall and so on. Original sin, I say. That's right, original sin. Oshima holds his pencil between his middle and index fingers, twirling it ever so slightly as if testing the balance. Anyway, my point is that it's really hard for people to live their lives alone. Back in the reading room, I return to the tale of Abu E. Hassan, the wag. But my mind wanders from the book. Male, 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 female, and female, female. At 2 o'clock, I lay down my book and get up from the sofa to join the tour of the building. Miss Saiki, leading the tour, is a slim woman, who I guess was in her mid-40s. She's a little on the tall side for someone of her generation. She's wearing a blue half-sleeve dress and a cream-coloured cardigan, and has excellent posture. Her long hair is loosely tied back, her face very refined and intelligent-looking, with beautiful eyes and a shadowy smile playing over her lips, a smile whose sense of completeness is indescribable. It reminds me of a small, sunny spot, the special patch of sunlight you find only in some remote, secluded place. My house in Tokyo has one just like it in the garden. And ever since I was very young, I loved that bright little place. She makes a strong impression on me, making me feel wistful and nostalgic. Wouldn't it be great if this were my mother? But I think the same thing every time I run across a charming middle-aged woman. The chances that Miss Saiki is actually my mother are close to zero, I realize. Still, since I have no idea what my mother looks like or even her name, the possibility does exist, right? There's nothing that rules it out completely. The only other people taking the tour are a middle-aged couple from Osaka. The wife is short and pudgy with glasses as thick as a Coke bottle. The husband's a skinny guy with hair so stiff I bet he needs a wire brush to tame it. With narrow eyes and a broad forehead, he reminds me of some statue on a southern island, eyes fixed on the horizon. The wife keeps up a one-sided conversation, her husband just grunting out a monosyllable every once in a while to let her know he's still alive. Other than that, he gives the occasional nod to show he's suitably impressed, or else mutters some fragmentary comment I can't catch. Both are dressed more for mountain climbing than for visiting a library, each wearing a waterproof sleeveless jacket with a million pockets, sturdy lace-up boots and mountain climbing hats. Maybe this is how they always dress when they go on a trip, who knows? They seem okay. Not that I'd want them as parents or anything. And I'm relieved to be not the only one taking the tour. Miss Saiki begins by explaining the library's history. Basically the same story Oshima told me. How they opened to the public, the books and paintings the umpteenth head of the family had collected, devoting the library to the region's cultural development. A foundation was set up, based on the Komura fortune, and now it managed the library and occasionally sponsored lectures, chamber music concerts, and the like. The building itself dated from the early Meiji period, when it was built to serve a double function as the family library and guest house. In the Taisho period, it was completely renovated as a two-story building, with the addition of magnificent guest rooms for visiting writers and artists. Many famous guests visited from Taisho to the early Showa period, and many famous artists visited the Komuras, leaving behind mementos, poems, sketches and paintings, in gratitude for having been allowed to stay here. You'll be able to view some selected items from this valuable collection in the first floor gallery, Miss Saiki adds. Before the Second World War, a vibrant local culture was established less through the efforts of local government than those of wealthy connoisseurs such as the Komura family. They were, in short, patrons of the arts. Kagawa Prefecture has produced quite a number of talented tanka and haiku poets, and one reason for this was the dedication with which the Komura family founded and supported the local art scene. Quite a number of books, essays and memoirs have been published on the history of these fascinating artistic circles, all of which are in our reading room. I hope you'll take the opportunity to look at them. The heads of the Komura family down through the years have been well versed in the arts, with an especially refined appreciation of the truly excellent. This might have run in the blood. They were discerning patrons of the arts, supporting artists with the highest aims who produced the most outstanding works. But as you are surely aware, in the arts there is no such thing as an absolutely perfect eye. Unfortunately, some exceptional artists did not win their favour, or were not received by them as they deserved to have been. One of these was the haiku poet Tanada Santoka. According to the guestbook, Santoka stayed here on numerous occasions, each time leaving behind drawings and poems. The head of the family, however, called him a beggar and a braggart, wouldn't have much to do with him, and in fact threw away most of these works. "What a terrible waste," the lady from Osaka says, apparently truly sorry to hear this. Nowadays, Santoka fetches a hefty price. "You're quite right," Miss Saiki says, beaming. "At the time, though, he was an unknown, so perhaps it couldn't be helped. There are many things we only see clearly in retrospect." "You got that right," the husband pipes in. After this, Miss Saiki guides us around the ground floor, showing us the stacks, the reading room, the rare books collection. When he built this library, the head of the family decided not to follow the simple and elegant style favoured by artists in Kyoto, instead choosing a design more like a rustic dwelling. Still, as you can see, in contrast to the bold structure of the building, the furnishings and picture frames are quite elaborate and luxurious. The carving of these wooden panels, for instance, is very elegant. All the finest master craftsmen in Shikoku were assembled to work on the construction. Our little group starts upstairs, a vaulted ceiling soaring over the staircase. The ebony railing's so highly polished it looks as though you'll leave a mark if you touch it. On a stained glass window next to the landing, a deer stretches its neck to nibble at some grapes. There are two parlours on the first floor, as well as a spacious hall that in the past was probably lined with tatami for banquets and gatherings. Now the floor is plain wood, and the walls are covered with framed calligraphy, hanging scrolls and Japanese-style paintings. In the centre, a glass case displays various mementos and the story behind each. One parlour is in the Japanese style, the other Western. The Western-style room contains a large writing desk and swivel chair that looks as if someone's still using it. There's a row of pines outside the window behind the desk, the horizon faintly visible between the trees. The couple from Osaka walks around the parlour, inspecting all the items, reading the explanations in the pamphlet. Every time the wife makes a comment, the husband chimes in to second her opinion. A lucky couple that agrees on everything. The things on display don't do much for me, so I study the details of the building's construction. While I'm nosing around the Western parlour, Miss Saiki comes up to me and says, "You can sit in that chair if you'd like to. Shiga Naoya and Tanizaki both sat there at one time or another. Not that this is the same chair, of course." I sit on the swivel chair and calmly lay my hands on the desk. "How is it? Feel like you could write something?" I blush a little and shake my head. Miss Saiki laughs and goes back to the couple. From the chair I watch how she carries herself, every motion natural and elegant. I can't express it well, but there's definitely something special about it, as if her retreating figure is trying to tell me something she couldn't express while she is facing me. But what this is, I have no idea. "Face it," I remind myself, "there are tons of things you have no idea about." Still seated, I give the room a once-over. On the wall is an oil painting, apparently of the seashore nearby. It's done in an old-fashioned style, but the colours are fresh and alive. On the desk is a large ashtray and a lamp with a green lampshade. I push the switch and, sure enough, the light comes on. A black clock hangs on the opposite wall, an antique by the look of it, though the hands tell the right time. There are round spots worn here and there into the wooden floor, and it creaks slightly when you walk on it. At the end of the tour, the Osaka couple thanks Miss Saiki and disappears. It turns out they're members of a tanka circle in the Kansai region. I wonder what kind of poems they compose, the husband especially. Grunts and nods don't add up to poetry. But maybe writing poetry brings out some hidden talent in him. I return to the reading room and pick up where I'd left off in my book. Over the afternoon, a few other readers drift in, most of them with those reading glasses old people wear and that everybody looks the same in. Time passes slowly. Nobody says a word, everyone lost in quiet reading. One person sits at a desk jotting down notes, but the rest are sitting there silently, not moving, totally absorbed. Just like me. At 5 o'clock, I shut my book and put it back on the shelf. At the desk on the way out, I ask, "What time do you open in the morning?" 11, Oshima replies. "Planning on coming back tomorrow?" "If it's no bother." Oshima narrows his eyes as he looks at me. "Of course not. A library's a place for people who want to read. I'd be happy if you came back. I hope you don't mind my asking, but do you always carry that backpack with you? It looks pretty heavy. What in the world could be inside?" "A stack of Krugerrands, perhaps?" I blush. "Don't worry. I'm not really trying to find out." Oshima presses the rubber end of his pencil against his right temple. "Well, see you tomorrow." "Bye," I say. Instead of raising his hand, he lifts his pencil in farewell. I take the train back to Takamatsu Station. For dinner, I stop inside a cheap cafe near the station and order chicken cutlet and a salad. I have a second helping of rice and a glass of warm milk after the meal. At a corner shop outside, I buy a bottle of mineral water and 2 rice balls in case I get hungry in the middle of the night, then start for my hotel. I walk not too fast or too slow, at an ordinary pace, just like everybody else, so no one notices me. The hotel is pretty large, a typical second-rate business hotel. I fill in the register at the front desk, giving Kafka, instead of my real first name, a phony address and age, and pay for one night. I'm a little nervous, but none of the clerks seems suspicious. Nobody yells out, "Hey, we can see right through your ruse, you little 15-year-old runaway." Everything goes smooth as silk, business as usual. The lift clanks alarmingly to the 5th floor. The room is minuscule, outfitted with an uninviting bed, a rock-hard pillow, a miniature excuse for a desk, tiny TV, sun-bleached curtains. The bathroom is barely the size of a cupboard, with none of those little complimentary shampoo or conditioner bottles. The view from the window is of the wall of the building next door. I shouldn't complain, though, since I have a roof over my head and hot water coming out of the tap. I plonk my backpack on the floor, sit on the chair, and try to acclimatize myself to the surroundings. I'm free, I think. I shut my eyes and think hard and deep about how free I am, but can't really understand what it means. All I know is I'm totally alone. All alone in an unfamiliar place, like some solitary explorer who's lost his compass and his map. Is that what it means to be free? I don't know, and I give up thinking about it. I take a long, hot bath and carefully brush my teeth in front of the sink. I flop down in bed and read, and when I get tired of that, I watch the news on TV. Compared to everything I've been through today, though, the news seems stale and boring. I switch off the TV and get under the covers. It's 10 p.m., but I can't get to sleep. A new day in a brand new place. And my 15th birthday besides. Most of which I'd spent in that charming, offbeat library. I've met a few new people. Sakura, Oshima, Miss Saiki. Nobody threatening, thank God. A good omen? I think about my home back in Nagata, in Tokyo, and my father. How did he feel when he discovered that I disappeared? Relieved, maybe? Confused? Or maybe nothing at all? I'm betting he hasn't even noticed I'm gone. I suddenly remember my father's mobile phone and take it out of my backpack. I switch it on and dial my home number. It starts ringing, 450 miles away, as clearly as if I was calling the room next door. Startled by this, I hang up after two rings. My heart won't stop pounding. The phone still works, which means that my father hasn't cancelled the contract. Maybe he hasn't noticed the phone's missing from his desk. I shove the phone back into the pocket of my backpack, turn off the light, and close my eyes. I don't dream. Come to think of it, I haven't had any dreams in a long time.
6. "Hello there," the old man called out. The large, elderly black tomcat raised its head a fraction and wearily returned the greeting in a low voice. "A very nice spell of weather we're having." The cat said. "Not a cloud in the sky."
"For the time being."
"Is the weather going to take a turn for the worse, then?"
"It feels like it'll cloud up towards evening."
The black cat slowly stretched out a leg, then narrowed its eyes and gave the old man another good long look. With a big grin on his face, the man stared right back. The cat hesitated for a time, then plunged ahead and spoke.
So you're able to speak?"
"That's right," the old man said bashfully. To show his respect, he took off his threadbare cotton walking hat. "Not that I can converse with every cat I meet, but if things go well, I can, as right now."
"Interesting," the cat said simply.
"Do you mind if I sit down here for a while? Nakata's a little tired from walking."
The black cat rose languidly to its feet, whiskers a-twitch, and yawned so tremendously that its jaw looked almost unhinged.
"I don't mind. Or perhaps I should say it's not up to me. You can sit anywhere you like. Nobody's going to bother you for that."
"Thank you kindly," the man said, lowering himself down beside the cat. "Boy, oh boy, I've been on the move since 6 this morning."
I take it, then, that you're Mr. Nakata."
"That's right. Nakata's the name. And you would be?"
"I forget my name," the cat said. "I had one, I know I did, but somewhere along the line I didn't need it any more, so it slipped my mind."
"I know. It's easy to forget things you don't need any more. Nakata's exactly the same way," the man said, scratching his head. "So what you're saying, Mr. Cat, is that you don't belong to some family somewhere?"
"A long time ago I did, but not any more. Some families in the neighbourhood give me food to eat now and then, but none of them own me."
Nakata nodded and was silent for a time, then said,
"Would you mind very much, then, if I called you Otsuka?"
"Otsuka?"
the cat said, looking at him in surprise.
"What are you talking about? Why do I have to be Otsuka?"
"No special reason. The name just came to me. Nakata just picked one out of a hat. It makes things a lot easier for me if you have a name. That way somebody like me, who isn't very bright, can organize things better. For instance, I can say, 'On this day of this month I spoke with the black cat Otsuka in a vacant plot of land in the Tuchome neighborhood.' It helps me remember."
"Interesting," the cat said. "Not that I totally follow you. Cats can get by without names. We go by smell, shape, things of this nature. As long as we know, there's no worries for us."
"Nakata understands completely. But you know, Mr. Otsuka, people don't work that way. We need dates and names to remember all kinds of things."
The cat gave a snort.
"Sounds like a pain to me."
"You're absolutely right. There's so much we have to remember. It is a pain. Nakata has to remember the name of the governor, bus numbers. Still, you don't mind if I call you Otsuka? Maybe it's a little unpleasant for you."
"Well, now that you mention it, I suppose it isn't all that pleasant. Not that it's particularly unpleasant, you understand. So I guess I don't really mind. You want to call me Otsuka? Be my guest. All the same, it doesn't sound right when you call me that.
Nakata's very happy to hear you say that. Thank you so much, Mr. Otsuka.
I must say, though, that for a human you have an odd way of talking, Otsuka commented.
Yes, everybody tells me that, but this is the only way Nakata can speak. I try to talk normally, but this is what happens. Nakata's not very bright, you see. I wasn't always this way, but when I was little, I was in an accident, and I've been dumb ever since. Nakata can't write, or read a book, or a newspaper.
Not to boast or anything, but I can't write either, the cat said, licking the pads of his right paw. I'd say my mind is average, though, so I've never found it inconvenient.
In the cat world, that's to be expected, Nakata said. But in the human world, if you can't read or write, you're considered dumb. Nakata's father, he passed away a long time ago, was a famous professor in a university. His speciality was something called theory of fine ants. I have two younger brothers, and they're both very bright. One of them works at a company, and he's a department chief. My other brother works at a place called the Ministry of Trade and Industry. They both live in huge houses and eat eel. Nakata's the only one who isn't bright.
But you're able to talk to cats.
That's correct, Nakata said.
Then you're not so dumb after all.
Yes. No. I mean, Nakata doesn't really know about that, but ever since I was little, people have said, you're dumb, you're dumb. So I suppose I must be. I can't read the names of stations, so I can't buy a ticket and take a train. If I show my handicap pass, though, they let me go on the city bus.
Interesting, Otsuka said without much interest.
If you can't read or write, you can't find a job.
Then how do you make a living?
I get a subsidy.
Subsidy?
The governor gives me money. I live in a little room in an apartment in Nogata called the Shoeso. And I eat 3 meals a day.
Sounds like a pretty good life, to me at least.
You're right. It is a pretty nice life. Nakata can keep out of the wind and rain, and I have everything I need. And sometimes, as now, people ask me to help them find cats. They give me a present when I do. But I've got to keep this secret from the governor, so don't tell anybody. They might cut down my subsidy if they find out I have some extra money coming in. It's never a lot, but thanks to it, I can eat eel every once in a while. Nakata loves eel.
I like eel, too. I only had it once, a long time ago, and can't really recall what it tastes like.
Eel is quite a treat. There's something different about it compared to other foods. Certain foods can take the place of others, but in my experience, nothing can take the place of eel.
On the road in front of the empty plot of land, a young man walked past with a large Labrador retriever with a red bandana tied round its neck. It glanced over at Otsuka, but walked on. The old man and the cat sat there in the plot, silently waiting for the dog and his master to disappear.
"You said you look for cats?" Otsuka asked.
"That's correct. I search for lost cats. I can speak to cats a little, so I go all over the place, tracking down ones that have gone missing. People heard that Nakata's good at this, so they come and ask me to look for their lost cats. These days I spend more days than not out searching for cats. I don't like to go too far away, so I just look for them inside Nakano Ward. Otherwise, I'll be the one lost and they'll be out looking for me.
So right now you're searching for a lost cat?
Yes, that's correct. Nakata's looking for a one-year-old tortoiseshell cat named Goma. Here's a photo of her.
Nakata pulled a color copy out of his canvas shoulder bag and showed it to Otsuka.
She's wearing a brown flea collar.
Otsuka stretched out to gaze at the photograph, then shook his head.
No, afraid I've never run across this one. I know most of the cats around here, but this one I don't know. Never seen or heard anything about her.
Is that right?
Have you been looking for her for a long time?
Well, today is, let me see, 1, 2, 3, the third day.
Otsuka sat there thinking for a time.
I assume you're aware of this, but cats are creatures of habit. Usually they live very ordered lives, and unless something extraordinary happens, they generally try to keep to their routine. What might disrupt this is either sex or an accident, one of the two.
Nakata's thinking the same thing.
If it's sex, then you just have to wait till they get it out of their system and they'll be back. You do understand what I mean by sex.
I haven't done it myself, but I think I understand. It has to do with your willy, right?
That's right. It's all about the willy.
Otsuka nodded, a serious look on his face.
If we're talking about an accident, though, you might never see her again.
That's true.
Also, sometimes when a cat's on the prowl for sex, it might wander off and have trouble finding its way home again.
If Nakata went out of Nakano Ward, finding my way home wouldn't be easy.
That's happened to me a few times. Of course, that was a long time ago when I was much younger,
Otsuka said, eyes narrowed as he searched his memory.
Once you're lost, you panic. You're in total despair, not knowing what to do. I hate it when that happens. Sex can be a real pain that way, because when you get in the mood, all you can think about is what's right under your nose. That's sex, all right. So that cat, what was her name, the one that's lost?
Do you mean Goma?
Yes, of course, Goma. I'd like to do what I can to help you find her. A young tortoiseshell cat like that, with some nice family taking care of her, would know the first thing about making her way in the world. Wouldn't be able to fight off anybody or fend for herself, the poor thing. Unfortunately, however, I've never seen her. I think you might want to search somewhere else.
Well, then, I suppose I should follow your advice and go to some other place to look. Nakata's very sorry to have interrupted your nap. I'm sure I'll stop by here again sometime, so if you spot Goma in the meantime, please let me know. I'd like to give you something for your help.
No need. I enjoyed talking to you. Feel free to drop by again. On sunny days, this is where you'll usually find me. When it rains, I'm generally in that shrine over there, where the steps go down.
Well, thank you very much. Nakata was very happy, too, to be able to talk to you, Mr. Otsuka. I can't speak so easily to every cat I meet. Sometimes when I try, the cat is on his guard and runs away without saying a word, when all I ever said was hello.
I can well imagine. There are all sorts of cats, just as there are all sorts of people.
That's exactly right. Nakata feels the same way. There are all kinds of people in the world, and all kinds of cats.
Otsuka stretched and looked up at the sky. Golden sunlight filled the vacant plot of land, but the air held a hint of rain, something Otsuka was able to sense.
Didn't you say that when you were little you had an accident, and that's why you're not so smart?
Yes, that's right. That's exactly what Nakata said. I had an accident when I was 9 years old.
What sort of accident?
Nakata can't really remember. They don't know why, but I had a high fever for about 3 weeks. I was unconscious the whole time. I was asleep in a bed in a hospital, they told me, with an intravenous.